breed for luck the way you breed for shaggy eyebrows. Yet you breed for telepathy. That's not the same. Telepathy isn't a psychic power. The mechanisms in the right parietal lobe are well mapped. They just don't work for most people. Telepathy was once thought to be a form of psi. Now you claim that luck is not. Luck is luck. The situation would have been funny as Teela thought it was, but Louis realized what she did not. The puppeteer was serious. The law of averages swings back and forth. The odds shift wrong and you're out of the game like the dinosaurs. The dice fall your way and... It is thought that some humans can direct the fall of a die. So I picked a bad metaphor. The point is...
Yes, the Kazin rumbled.
He had a voice to shake walls when he chose to use it.
The point is that we will accept whom Nessus chooses. You own the ship, Nessus. Where, then, is our fourth crewman?
Here in this room. Now just a tonj minute. Teela stood up. The silver netting flashed like real metal across her blue skin. Her hair floated flaming in the draft from the air conditioner. This whole thing is ridiculous. I'm not going anywhere. Why should I?
Pick someone else, Nessus. There must be millions of qualified candidates. Where's the hang-up?
Not millions, Louis. We have a few thousand names and phone numbers or private transfer booth numbers for most of them. Each can claim 5 generations of ancestors born by virtue of winning lottery tickets.
Well?
Nessus began to pace the floor. Many disqualify themselves by obvious bad luck. Of the rest, none seem to be available. When we call, they are out. When we call back, the phone computer gives us a bad connection. When we ask for any member of the Brandt family, every phone in South America rings. There have been complaints. It's very frustrating. Tap, 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 tap.
Teela said, "You haven't even told me where you're going."
"I cannot name our destination, Teela. However, you may..."
"Finnegal's Red Claws. You won't even tell us that?"
"You may examine the holo Louis Wu is carrying. That is the only information I can give you at this time."
Louis handed her the holo, the one showing a baby blue stripe across a black background behind a disk of blazing white. She took her time looking it over, and only Louis noticed how the angry blood flowed into her face. When she spoke, she spit the words out one at a time, like the seeds of a tangerine.
"This is the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard of. You expect Louis and me to go charging out beyond known space with a Kazin and a puppeteer for company, and all we know about where we're going is a length of blue ribbon and a light spot? That's ridiculous." "I take it, then, that you refuse to join us."
The girl's eyebrows went up.
"I must have a direct answer. Soon my agents may locate another candidate."
"Yes," said Teela Brown. "Yes, I do refuse."
"Remember, then, that by human law you must keep secret the things you have been told here. You have been paid a consultant's fee."
"Who would I tell?" Teela laughed dramatically. "Who would believe me? Louis, are you really going on this ridiculous..."
"Yes."
Louis was already thinking of other things, like a tactful way to get her out of the office. "But not right this minute. There's still a party going on. Look, do something for me, will you? Switch the music master from tape 4 to tape 5. Then tell anyone who asks that I'll be out in a minute."
When the door had closed behind her, Louis said, "Do me a favor. Do yourselves one, too. Let me be the judge of whether a human being is qualified for a jaunt into the unknown." "You know what qualifications are paramount," said Nessus. "We do not yet have 2 candidates to choose from."
"You've got tens of thousands."
"Not really. Many disqualify themselves. Others cannot be found. However, you may tell me where that human being fails to fit your own qualifications."
"She's too young."
"No candidate can qualify without being of Teela Brown's generation."
"Breeding for luck? No, never mind. I won't argue the point. I know humans crazier than that. A couple of them are still here at the party. Well, you saw for yourself that she's no xenophile."
"Nor is she a xenophobe. She does not fear either of us."
"She doesn't have the spark. She isn't... She has no restlessness, said Nessus. She is happy where she is. This is indeed a liability. There is nothing she wants. Yet how could we know this without asking?
Okay, pick your own candidates.
Louis stalked from his office. Behind him, the puppeteer fluted,
Louis, speaker, the signal. One of my agents has found another candidate.
He sure has, Louis said disgustedly. Across the living room, Teela Brown was glaring at another Pearson's puppeteer.
Louis woke slowly. He remembered donning a sleep headset and setting it for an hour of current. Presumably that had been an hour ago. After the set turned itself off, the discomfort of having the thing on his head would have awakened him. It wasn't on his head. He sat up abruptly.
I took it off you, said Teela Brown. You needed the sleep.
Oh, boy. What time is it?
A little after 17.
I've been a bad host. How goes the party?
Down to about 20 people. Don't worry, I told them what I was doing. They all thought it was a good idea.
Okay. Louis rolled off the bed. Thanks. Shall we join what's left of the party?
I'd like to talk to you first.
He sat down again. The muzziness of sleep was slowly leaving him. He asked, What about?
You're really going on this crazy trip?
I really am.
I don't see why.
I'm 10 times your age, said Louis Wu. I don't have to work for a living. I don't have the patience to be a scientist. I did some writing once, but it turned out to be hard work, which was the last thing I expected. What's left? I play a lot.
She shook her head, and firelight shivered on the walls.
It doesn't sound like playing.
Louis shrugged.
Boredom is my worst enemy. It's killed a lot of my friends, but it won't get me. When I get bored, I go risk my life somewhere.
Shouldn't you at least know what the risk is?
I'm getting well paid.
You don't need the money.
The human race needs what the puppeteers have got.
Look, Teela, you were told all about the second quantum hyperdrive ship. It's the only ship in known space that moves faster than 3 days to the light year, and it goes almost 400 times that fast.
Who needs to fly that fast?
Louis wasn't in the mood to deliver a lecture on the core explosion. Let's get back to the party.
No, wait.
Okay.
Her hands were large, with long, slender fingers. They glowed in reflected light as she brushed them nervously through her burning hair.
Tanj, I'm messing this up. Louis, are you in love with anyone right now?
That surprised him.
I don't think so.
Do I really look like Paula Cherenkov?
In the semi-darkness of the bedroom, she looked like the burning giraffe in the Dali painting. Her hair glowed by its own light, a stream of orange and yellow flame darkening to smoke. In that light, the rest of Teela was shadow touched by the flickering light of her hair. But Louis's memory filled in the details. The long, perfect legs, the conical breasts, the delicate beauty of her small face. He had first seen her 4 days ago on the arm of Tendrin Dohini, a spindly crash lander who had journeyed to Earth for the party.
I thought you were Paula herself, he said now.
She lives on We Made It, which is where I met Ted Dohini. When I saw you together, I thought Ted and Paula had come on the same ship. Close up, there were differences. You've got better legs, but Paula's walk was more graceful. Paula's face was colder, I think. Maybe that's just memory. From outside the door came bursts of computer music, wild and pure, strangely incomplete without the light patterns to make it whole. Teela shifted restlessly, stirring the firelight shadows on the wall.
What have you got in mind? Remember, said Louis, the puppeteers have thousands of candidates to choose from. They could find our fourth crewman any day, any minute. Then off we go.
That's all right, said Teela.
You'll stay with me until then?
Teela nodded her fiery head. The puppeteer dropped in 2 days later. Louis and Teela were out on the lawn, soaking up sunshine and playing a deadly serious game of fairy chess. Louis had spotted her a knight. Now he was regretting it. Teela alternated intellection with intuition. He could never tell which way she would jump, and she played for blood. She was chewing gently at her underlip, considering her next move, when the servo slid up and bonged at them. Louis glanced up at the monitor screen, saw two one-eyed pythons looking out of the servo's chest. "Send them out here," he said comfortably. Teela stood in one sudden graceless motion.
"You two may have secrets."
"Maybe. What do you have in mind?"
"Some reading to catch up on."
She leveled a forefinger at him.
"Don't touch that board."
At the door, she met the puppeteer coming out. She waved casually as they passed, and Nessus leapt 6 feet to the side.
"I beg your pardon," he fluted. "You startled me."
Teela lifted an eyebrow and went inside. The puppeteer stopped next to Louis and folded his legs under him. One head fixed on Louis, the other moved nervously, circling, covering all angles of vision.
"Could the woman spy on us?"
Louis showed his surprise.
"Sure. You know there's no defense against the spy beam, not in the open. So?" "Anyone or anything could be watching us. Louis, let us go to your office."
"There ain't no justice." Louis was perfectly comfortable where he was. "Will you stop bobbing your head around, please? You act scared to death."
"I am frightened, though I know my death would matter little. How many meteorites fall to Earth in a year?"
"I wouldn't know."
"We are perilously close to the asteroid belt here. Yet it does not matter, for we have been unable to contact a fourth crew member."
"Too bad," said Louis. The puppeteer's behavior puzzled him. If Nessus had been human, but he wasn't. "You haven't given up, I trust."
"No, but our failures have been galling. For these past 4 days, we've been seeking a Norman Haywood, KJMM-CWTAD, a perfect choice for our crew."
"And?"
"His health is perfect and vigorous. His age, 24 1/3 terrestrial years. 6 generations of his ancestors were all born through winning lottery tickets. Best of all, he enjoys travel. He exhibits the restlessness we need." "Naturally, we tried to contact him in person. For 3 days, my agent tracked him through a series of transfer booths, always a jump behind him, while Norman Haywood went skiing in Suisse and surfing in Ceylon, to shops in New York, and to house parties in the Rockies and the Himalayas. Last night, my agent caught up to him as he entered a passenger spacecraft bound for Jinx. The ship departed before my agent could conquer his natural fear of your jury-rigged ships."
"I've had days like that myself. Couldn't you send him a hyperwave message?"
"Louis, this voyage is supposed to be secret."
"Yeah," said Louis. And he watched a python head circling, circling, searching out unseen enemies.
"We will succeed," said Nessus. "Thousands of potential crew members cannot hide forever. Can they, Louis? They do not even know we are seeking them."
"You'll find someone you're bound to."
"I pray that we do not. Louis, how can I do it? How can I ride with 3 aliens in an experimental ship designed for 1 pilot? It would be madness."
"Nessus, what's really bugging you? This whole trip was your idea."
"It was not. My orders came from those who lead, from 200 light-years away."
"Something's terrified you. I want to know what it is. What have you found out? Do you know what this trip is really all about? What's changed since you were ready to insult 4 Kazinti in a public restaurant? Hey, easy, easy." The puppeteer had tucked his heads and necks between his forelegs and rolled into a ball. "Come on," said Louis. "Come on out." He ran his hands gently along the backs of the puppeteer's necks, the parts that showed. The puppeteer shuddered. His skin was soft, like chamois skin, and pleasant to the touch. "Come on out of there. Nothing's going to hurt you here. I protect my guests." The puppeteer's wail came muffled from under his belly.
"I was mad, mad. Did I really insult 4 Kazinti?
"Come on out. You're safe here." "That's better." A flat head peeped out of the warm shadow. "Now you see, nothing to be afraid of."
4 Kazinti, not 3?
"My mistake. I miscounted. It was 3.
"Ah, forgive me, Louis."
The puppeteer exposed his other head as far as the eye.
"My manic phase has ended.
I'm in the depressive leg of my cycle.
Can you do anything about it? Louis thought of the consequences if Nessus should hit the wrong leg of his cycle at a crucial time.
I can wait for it to end. I can protect myself to the extent possible. I can try not to let it affect my judgment.
Poor Nessus. You sure you haven't learned anything new?
Do I not know enough already to terrify any sane mind?
The puppeteer stood up somewhat shakily.
Why did I meet Teela Brown? I thought she would have departed.
I asked her to stay with me until we find your fourth crewmate.
Why?
Louis had wondered about that himself. It had little to do with Paula Cherenkov. Louis had changed too much since her time, and he was not a man to force one woman into the mold of another. Sleeping plates were designed for two occupants, not one. But there had been other girls at the party, not as pretty as Teela. Could wise old Louis Wu still be snared by beauty alone? But something more than beauty looked out of those flat silver eyes, something highly complex. "For purposes of fornication," said Louis Wu. He had remembered that he was talking to an alien who would not understand such complexities. He realized that the puppeteer was still shivering, and added, "Let's go to my office. It's under the hill. No meteors." After the puppeteer left, Louis went looking for Teela. He found her in the library, in front of a reading screen, clicking frames past at a speed high even for a speed reader.
"Hi,"
she said. She froze a frame and turned.
"How's our two-headed friend?"
"Scared witless, and I'm exhausted. I've been playing psychiatrist to a Pearson's puppeteer." Teela brightened.
"Tell me about a puppeteer's sex life."
"All I know is he isn't allowed to breed. He broods on it. One may assume that he could breed if there weren't a law against it. Aside from that, he stayed off the subject completely. Sorry."
"Well, what did you talk about?"
Louis waved a hand. 300 years of traumas. That's how long Nessus has been in human space. He hardly remembers the puppeteer planet. I get the feeling he's been scared for 300 years. Louis dropped into a masseur chair. The strain of empathizing with an alien had exhausted his mind, used up his imagination. "How about you? What are you reading?"
"The core explosion."
Teela waved at the reading screen. "There were stars in clusters and bunches and masses. You couldn't see black, there were so many stars. It might have been a dense star cluster, but it wasn't. It couldn't be. Telescopes couldn't reach that far, nor would any normal spacecraft. It was the galactic core, 5,000 light-years across, a tight sphere of stars at the axis of the galactic whirlpool. One man had reached that far, 200 years ago, in an experimental puppeteer-built ship. The frame showed red and blue and green stars, all superimposed, the red stars biggest and brightest. In the center of the picture was a patch of blazing white, the shape of a bloated comma. Within it were lines and blobs of shadow. But the shadow within the white patch was brighter than any star outside it."
"That's why you need the puppeteer ship," said Teela, "isn't it?"
"Right."
"How did it happen?"
"The stars are too close together," said Louis. "An average of half a light year apart, all through the core of any galaxy. Near the center, they're packed even tighter. In a galactic core, stars are so close to each other that they can heat each other up. Being hotter, they burn faster. They age faster. All the stars of the core must have been just that much closer to going nova 10,000 years ago. Then one star went nova. It let loose a lot of heat and a blast of gamma rays. The few stars around it got that much hotter. I gather the gamma rays also make for increased stellar activity. So a couple of neighboring stars blew up. That made three. The combined heat set off a few more. It was a chain reaction. Pretty soon there was no stopping it. That white patch is all supernovae. If you like, you can get the math of it a little further along in the tape."
"No thanks," she said predictably. "I gather it's all over by now?"
"Yeah, that's old light you're looking at, though it hasn't reached this part of the galaxy yet. The chain reaction must have ended 10,000 years ago."
"Then what's everyone excited about?"
"Radiation. Fast particles, all kinds." The masseur chair was beginning to relax him.
He settled deeper into its formless bulk and let the standing wave patterns knead his muscles.
Look at it this way. Known space is a little bubble of stars 33,000 light-years out from the galactic axis. The Novi began exploding more than 10,000 years ago. That means that the wavefront from the combined explosion will get here in about 20,000 years, right?
Sure.
And the subnuclear radiation from a million Novi is traveling right behind the wavefront.
Oh.
In 20,000 years, we'll have to evacuate every world you ever heard of, and probably a lot more.
That's a long time. If we started now, we could do it with the ships we've got, easily.
You're not thinking. At 3 days to the light year, it would take one of our ships about 600 years to reach the clouds of Magellan.
They could stop off to get more food and air, every year or so.
Louis laughed. Try talking anyone into that. You know what I think? When the light of the core explosion starts shining through the dust clouds between here and the galactic axis, that's when everyone in human space is suddenly going to get terrified. Then they'll have a century to get out. The puppeteers had the right idea. They sent a man to the core as a publicity stunt because they wanted financing for research. He sent back pictures like that one. Before he'd even landed, the puppeteers were gone. There wasn't a puppeteer on any human world. We won't do it that way. We'll wait and we'll wait, and when we finally decide to move, we'll have to ship trillions of sentient beings completely out of the galaxy. We'll need the biggest, fastest ships we can build, and we'll need as many as we can get. We need the puppeteer drive now, so that we can start improving it now.
Okay, I'm going with you.
Louis, interrupted in mid-lecture, said,
Huh?
I'm going with you, said Teela Brown.
You're out of your mind.
Well, you're going, aren't you?
Louis clamped his teeth on the explosion. When he did speak, he spoke more calmly than the situation deserved.
Yes, I'm going, but I've got reasons you don't, and I'm better at staying alive than you are because I've been at it longer.
But I'm luckier,
Louis snorted.
And my reasons for going may not be as good as yours, but they're good enough.
Her voice was high and thin with anger.
The Tanj they are.
Teela tapped the face of the reading screen. A bloated comma of Nova light flared beneath her fingernail.
That's not a good reason.
We'll get the puppeteer drive whether you come or not. You heard Nessus, there are thousands like you.
And I'm one of them.
All right, you're one of them, Louis flared.
What are you so Tanj protective about? Did I ask for your protection?
I apologize. I don't know why I tried to dictate to you. You're a free adult.
Thank you. I intend to join your crew.
Teela had gone icily formal. The hell of it was, she was a free adult. Not only could she not be coerced, an attempt to order her about would be bad manners and, more to the point, wouldn't work. But she could be persuaded.
Then think about this, said Louis Wu. Nessus has gone to great lengths to protect the secrecy of this trip.
Why, what's he got to hide?
That's his business, isn't it? Maybe there's something worth stealing wherever we're going.
So what? Where we're going is 200 light-years from here. We're the only ones who can get there.
The ship itself, then?
Whatever was unusual about Teela, she was no dummy. Louis himself hadn't thought of that.
Then think about our crew, he said. Two humans, a puppeteer, and a Kazin. None of us professional explorers.
I see what you're doing, but honestly, Louis, I am going. I doubt you can stop me.
Then you can at least know what you're getting into. Why the odd crew?
That's Nessus's problem.
I'd say it's ours.
Nessus gets his orders directly from those who lead, from the puppeteer headquarters. I think he figured out what those orders meant just a few hours ago. Now he's terrified. Those priests of survival have got four games going at once, not counting whatever it is we'll be exploring.
He saw that he had Teela's interest, and he pressed on.
First there's Nessus. If he's mad enough to land on an unknown world, can he possibly be sane enough to survive the experience?
Those who lead have to know. After they reach the clouds of Magellan, they'll have to set up another commercial empire. The backbone of their commerce is the mad puppeteers. Then there's our furry friend. As ambassador to an alien race, he should be one of the most sophisticated Kzinti around. Is he sophisticated enough to get along with the rest of us, or will he kill us for elbow room and fresh meat? Third, there's you and your presumed luck, a blue sky research project if I ever heard of one. Fourth is me, a presumably typical explorer type. Maybe I'm the control. You know what I think? Louis was standing over the girl now, pounding his words home with an oratorical technique he'd mastered while losing an election for the UN in his middle 70s. He would honestly have denied trying to browbeat Teela Brown, but he wanted desperately to convince her. The puppeteers couldn't care less about whatever planet we're being sent to. Why should they when they're leaving the galaxy? They're testing our little team to destruction. Before we get ourselves killed, the puppeteers can find out a lot about how we interact. I don't think it's a planet, said Teela. Louis exploded.
Tanj, what has that got to do with it?
Well, after all, Louis, if we're going to get killed exploring it, we might as well know what it is. I think it's a spacecraft.
You do?
A big one. A ring-shaped one with a ram scoop field to pick up interstellar hydrogen. I think it's built to funnel the hydrogen into the axis for fusion. You'd get thrust that way, and a sun, too. You'd spin the ring for centrifugal force, and you'd roof the inner side with glass.
Yeah, said Louis, thinking of the odd picture in the holo he'd been given by the puppeteer. He'd spent too little time wondering about their destination.
Could be. Big and primitive and not very easy to steer. But why would those who lead be interested?
It could be a refugee ship. Core races would learn about stellar processes early, with the suns so close together. They might have predicted the explosion thousands of years ahead, when there were only two or three supernovas.
Supernovae.
Could be.
And you've sneaked me right off the subject. I've told you what kind of game I think the puppeteers are playing. I'm going anyway for the fun of it. What makes you think you want to go?
The core explosion.
Altruism is great, but you couldn't possibly be worried about something that's supposed to happen in 20,000 years. Try again.
Damn it, if you can be a hero, so can I. And you're wrong about Nessus. He'd back out of a suicide mission, and why would the puppeteers want to know anything about us or the Kzinti either? What would they test us for? They're leaving the galaxy. They'll never have anything to do with us again.
No, Teela wasn't stupid, but... You're wrong. The puppeteers have excellent reasons for wanting to know all about us.
Teela's look dared him to back it up.
We don't know much about the puppeteer migration. We do know that every able-bodied, sane-minded puppeteer now alive is on the move. And we know that they're moving at just below light speed. The puppeteers are afraid of hyperspace. Now, traveling at just below light speed, the puppeteer fleet should reach the Lesser Cloud of Magellan in about 85,000 years. And what do they expect to find when they get there?
He grinned at her and gave her the punchline.
Us, of course. Humans and Kzinti, at least.
Cadet Lino and Pierin and Dolphins, probably.
They know we'll wait until the last minute and then run for it. And they know we'll use faster-than-light drives. By the time the puppeteers reach the cloud, they'll have to deal with us, or with whatever kills us off. And by knowing us, they can predict the nature of the killer. Oh, they've got reason enough to study us.
Okay.
Still want to go?
Teela nodded.
Why?
I'll reserve that.
Teela's composure was complete. And what could Louis do about it? Had she been under 19, he would have called one of her parents. But at 20, she was a presumed adult. You had to draw the line somewhere. As an adult, she had freedom of choice. She was entitled to expect good manners from Louis Wu. Certain areas of her privacy were sacrosanct. Louis could only persuade, and at that he had failed. So that Teela didn't have to do what she did next. She suddenly took his hands and, smiling, pleading, said,
"Take me with you, Louis. I'm luck. Really, I am. If Nessus didn't choose right, you could wind up sleeping alone. You'd hate that. I know you would."
She had him in a box. He couldn't keep her off Nessus's ship, not when she could go directly to the puppeteer.
"All right," he said. "We'll call him."
And he would hate sleeping alone.
Chapter 4. Speaker to Animals. I want to join the expedition, Teela said into the phone screen. The puppeteer howled on a long-drawn E-flat note. I beg your pardon?
Excuse me, said the puppeteer. Report to Outback Field, Australia, tomorrow at 0800. Bring personal possessions, not to exceed 50 pounds, earth weight. Louis, you will do the same. Ah.
The puppeteer raised his heads and howled. Anxiously, Louis demanded, Are you sick?
No, I foresee my own death. Louis, I wish that you had been less persuasive. Farewell. We meet at Outback Field.
The screen went dark. See? Teela crowed. See what you get for being so persuasive? Me and my silver tongue. Well, I did my oratorical best. Don't blame me if you die horribly. That night, freely falling in darkness, Louis heard her say,
I love you. I'm going with you because I love you.
Love you too, he said with sleepy good manners. Then it percolated through and he said, That's what you were reserving?
Mm-hmm.
You're following me 200 light-years because you can't bear to let me go.
Yup.
Sleep room half-light, said Louis. Dim blue light filled the room. They floated a foot apart between the sleeping plates. In preparation for space, they had cleaned off the skin dyes and hair treatments of Flatland style. The hair in Louis's queue was now straight and black. His scalp was gray with stubble. Yellow-brown skin tones, brown eyes with no perceptible slant, changed his image considerably. The changes in Teela were equally drastic. Her hair was dark and wavy now, tied back from her face. Her skin was Nordic pale. Her oval face was dominated by big brown eyes and a small serious mouth. Her nose was almost unnoticeable. In the sleeping field, she floated like oil on water, utterly relaxed.
But you've never been as far as the moon.
She nodded.
And I'm not the world's greatest lover. You told me that yourself.
She nodded again. There was no reticence in Teela Brown. In 2 days and nights, she had not lied, nor shaded the truth, nor so much as dodged a question. Louis would have known. She had told him of her first two loves, the one who had lost interest in her after half a year, the other, a cousin, who had been offered a chance to emigrate to Mount Lookatthat. Louis had told her little of his own experience, and she had seemed to accept his reticence. But she had none. And she asked the damnedest questions.
Then why me? He asked.
I don't know, she confessed. Could it be the charisma? You're a hero, you know.
He was the only living man to have made first contact with an alien species. Would he ever live down the Trinnock episode? He made one more try. Look, I know the world's greatest lover, friend of mine. It's his hobby. He writes books about it. He's got doctorates in physiology and psychology. For the past 130 years, he's been... Teela had her hands over her ears.
Don't, she said, don't.
I just don't want you to get killed somewhere. You're too young. She wore the puzzled look, that puzzled look, the one that meant he'd used proper interworld words in a nonsense sequence. Whiplash of the heart? Killed somewhere? Louis sighed within himself.
Sleep room nodes merge, he said, and something happened to the sleeper field. The two regions of stable equilibrium, the anomalies which kept Louis and Teela from falling out of the field, moved together and merged into one. Louis and Teela followed, sliding downhill until they bumped and clung.
I really was sleepy, Louis, but never mind.
Think about privacy before you drift away to dreamland. Spacecraft tend to be cramped.
You mean we couldn't make love? Tange, Louis, I don't care if they watch. They're aliens.
I care. She gave him that puzzled look.
Suppose they weren't aliens, then would you object?
Yes, unless we knew them very well. Does that make me out of date?
A little.
Remember that friend I mentioned, the world's greatest lover? Well, he had a colleague, said Louis, and she taught me some things he was teaching her. You need gravity for this, he added. Sleep room field off. Wait returned.
You're trying to change the subject, said Teela.
Yes, I give up.
Okay, but just keep one thing in mind. One thing.
Your puppeteer friend might have wanted 4 species instead of 3. You could just as easily be holding a Trinnock instead of me.
Horrible thought. Now, we do this in 3 stages, starting with straddle position.
What's straddle position?
I'll show you.
By morning, Louis was glad enough that they would be traveling together. When his doubts returned, it was too late. It had already been too late for some considerable time. The outsiders were traders in information. They bought high and they sold high, but what they bought once they sold again and again, for their trading ground was the entire galactic whorl. In the banks of human space, their credit was virtually unlimited. Presumably they had evolved in some cold, light moon of a gas giant, some world very like Nereid, Neptune's larger moon. Now they lived in the gaps between the stars, in city-sized ships whose sophistication varied enormously, from photon sails to engines theoretically impossible to human science. Where a planetary system held potential customers, and where such a system included a suitable world, the outsiders would lease space for trade centers, rest and recreation areas, supply dumps. 6,000 years ago, they had leased Nereid.
"And that must be their major trade area," said Louis Wu.
"Down there." He pointed with one hand, keeping the other on the controls of the transport ship. Nereid was an icy, craggy plain beneath bright starlight. The sun was a fat white point giving off as much light as a full moon, and that light illuminated a maze of low walls. There were hemispherical buildings and a cluster of small thruster-driven ground-to-orbit ships with passenger sections open to space, but more than half the plain was covered with those low walls.
Speaker to animals, hovering hugely between Louis, said, "I would like to know the purpose of the maze. Defense?"
"Basking areas," said Louis. "The outsiders live on thermoelectricity. They lie with their heads in sunlight and their tails in shadow, and the temperature difference between the two sets up a current. The walls are to make more shadow border lines."
Nessus had calmed down during the 10-hour flight. He trotted about the life system of the transport ship, inspecting this and that, poking a head and eye into corners, tossing comments and answers to questions over his shoulder. His pressure suit, a baggy balloon with padding over the hump that concealed his brain, looked light and comfortable. The air and food regenerator packages were improbably small. He had given them a strange moment just before takeoff. Music had played suddenly through the cabin, complex and lovely, rich in minor tones, like the sad call of a sex-maddened computer. Nessus whistled. With his twin mouths, rich in nerves and muscles appropriate to mouths, which were also hands, the puppeteer was a walking orchestra. He had insisted that Louis fly the craft, and his confidence in Louis's ability was such that he had not strapped down. Louis suspected special secret gadgets to protect the passengers of the puppeteer-built ship. Speaker had come aboard with a 20-pound luggage case which, when opened, had held little more than a collapsed microwave oven for heating meat. That, and a haunch of raw something or other, of Kazinti rather than terrestrial origin. For some reason, Louis had expected the Kazin's pressure suit to look like bulky medieval armor. It didn't. It was a multiple balloon, transparent, with a monstrously heavy backpack and a fishbowl helmet packed with esoteric-looking tongue controls. Though it held no identifiable weapons, the backpack had a look of battle gear, and Nessus had insisted that he store it. The Kazin had spent most of the voyage napping, and now they all stood looking over Louis's shoulder.
"I'll drop us next to the outsider ship," said Louis.
"No, take us east. We've been using an isolated area to park the long shot."
"What for? Would the outsiders spy on you?"
"No. The long shot uses fusion drives instead of thrusters. The heat of takeoffs and landings would disturb the outsiders."
"Why long shot?"
"It was so named by Beowulf Schaefer, the only sentient being ever to fly that ship. He took the only extant holographs of the core explosion. Is not long shot a gambler's term?"
"Maybe he didn't expect to come back. I'd better tell you, I've never flown anything with a fusion drive. My ship rides on reactionless thrusters, just like this one."
"You must learn,"
said Nessus.
Wait, said Speaker to Animals. I myself have had experience with fusion-driven spacecraft, therefore I will pilot the long shot.
Impossible. The pilot's crash couch is designed to fit a human frame. The control panels follow human custom.
The Kazin made angry noises deep in his throat.
There, Louis, ahead of us.
The long shot was a transparent bubble over 1,000 feet in diameter. As Louis guided their craft to circle the behemoth, he could find no cubic inch of her that was not packed with the green and bronze machinery of hyperspace shunt motors. Her hull was a General Products No. 4 hull, easily recognized by one familiar with spacecraft, so big that it was commonly used only to ship entire prefab colonies. But she didn't look like a spacecraft. She was the tremendous counterpart of some primitive orbital satellite, built by a race whose limited resources and limited technology required that every smallest bit of space be used.
"And where do we sit?" Louis inquired. "On top?"
"The cabin is underneath. Land beneath the curve of the hull."
Louis brought his ship down on dark ice, then slid her carefully forward under the bulging belly of the long shot. There were lights in the life system. They gleamed through the long shot's hull. Louis saw two tiny rooms, the lower just big enough to hold a crash couch and a mass indicator and a horseshoe-shaped bank of instruments, the upper room no larger. He felt the Kazin move up behind him.
"Interesting," said the Kazin. "I presume that Louis is intended to ride in the lower compartment and we three in the upper."
"Yes. The fitting of three crash couches into so small a space gave us considerable difficulty. Each is equipped with a stasis field for maximum safety. Since we will ride in stasis, it matters little that there is no room to move about."
The Kazin snorted, and Louis felt him leave his shoulder. He let the ship settle a last few inches, then snapped off a succession of switches.
"I have a point to make," he said. "Teela and I are collecting the same fee between us that Speaker to Animals is collecting alone."
"Do you wish additional pay? I will consider your suggestions."
"I want something you don't need anymore," Louis told the puppeteer. "Something your race left behind them."
He'd picked a good moment for bargaining. He didn't expect it to work, but it was certainly worth a try.
"I want the location of the puppeteer planet."
Nessus's heads swung out from their shoulders, then turned back to face each other. For a moment, Nessus held his own stare before asking, "Why?"
"Once upon a time, the location of the puppeteer world was the most valuable secret in known space. Your own kind would have paid a fortune in blackmail to keep that secret," said Louis. "That was what made it valuable. Fortune hunters searched every G and K star in sight looking for the puppeteer world. Even now, Teela and I could sell the information to any news network for good money."
"But if that world is outside known space?"
"Ah," said Louis. "My history teacher used to wonder about that. The information would still be worth money."
"Before we depart for our ultimate destination," the puppeteer said carefully, "you will know the coordinates of the puppeteer world. I think you will find the information more surprising than useful."
Again, for a heartbeat, the puppeteer peered into his own eyes. He broke the pose.
"I direct your attention to four conical projections."
"Yeah."
Louis had already noticed the open-mouthed cones, pointing outward and downward around the double cabin.
"Are those the fusion motors?"
"Yes. You will find that the ship behaves very like a ship driven by reactionless thrusters, except that there is no internal gravity. Our designers had little room to spare. Concerning the operation of the Quantum II hyperdrive, there is a thing I must warn you about."
"I have a variable sword," said Speaker to Animals. "I urge calm."
It took a moment for the words to register.
Then Louis turned, slowly, making no sudden gestures. The Kazin stood against a curved wall. In one clawed fist he held something like an oversized jump rope handle. 10 feet from the handle, held expertly at the level of the Kazin's eyes, was a small glowing red ball. The wire which joined ball to handle was too thin to be visible, but Louis didn't doubt it was there. Protected and made rigid by a slaver stasis field, the wire would cut through most metals, including, if Louis should choose to hide behind it, the back of Louis's crash couch.
and the Kazin had chosen a position such that he could strike anywhere in the cabin. At the Kazin's feet, Louis saw the unidentified haunch of alien meat. It had been ripped open, and, of course, it had been made hollow.
"I would have preferred a more merciful weapon," said Speaker to Animals. "A stunner would have been ideal. I could not procure one in time. Louis, take your hands off the controls and put them on the back of your couch."
Louis did. He had thought of playing with the cabin gravity, but the Kazin would have cut him in two if he'd tried it.
"Now, if you will all remain calm, I will tell you what will happen next."
"Tell us why," Louis suggested. He was estimating chances. The red bulb was an indicator to tell Speaker where his invisibly thin wire blade ended. But if Louis could grab that end of the blade and keep from losing his fingers in the process... No, the bulb was too small.
"My motive should be obvious," said Speaker.
The black markings around his eyes had taken on the look of a bandit's mask in a cartoon. The Kazin was neither tense nor relaxed, and he stood where he was almost impossible to attack.
"I intend to give my world control of the Long Shot. With the Long Shot as a model, we will build more such ships. Such ships would give us a killing superiority in the next Man-Kazin war, provided that men do not also have designs for Long Shot. Satisfactory?"
Louis made his voice sarcastic. "You couldn't be afraid of where we're going."
"No."
The insult slid right past him. How would a Kazin recognize sarcasm?
"You will all disrobe now, so that I may know that you are unarmed. When you have done so, I will request the puppeteer to don his pressure suit. We will board the Long Shot. Louis and Teela will stay behind, but I will take your clothing and your luggage and your pressure suits. I will disable this ship. Doubtless the outsiders, curious as to why you are not returned to Earth, will come to help you long before your life system fails. Do you all understand?"
Louis Wu, relaxed and ready to take advantage of any slip the Kazin might make. Louis Wu glanced at Teela Brown from the corner of his eye and saw a horrible thing. Teela was bracing herself to jump the Kazin. Speaker would cut her in two. Louis would have to move first.
"Don't be foolish, Louis. Stand up slowly and move against the wall. You shall be the first to..."
Speaker let the word trail off in a kind of croon. Louis halted his leap, caught by a thing he didn't understand. Speaker to Animals threw back his big orange head and mewed, an almost supersonic squeal. He threw his arms wide, as if to embrace the universe. The wire blade of his variable sword cut through a water tank without slowing noticeably. Water began dripping out on all four sides of the tank. Speaker didn't notice. His eyes didn't see, his ears didn't hear.
"Take his weapon," said Nessus.
Louis moved. He approached cautiously, ready to duck if the variable sword should move his way. The Kazin was waving it gently, like a baton. Louis took the handle from the Kazin's unresisting fist. He touched the proper stud, and the red ball retracted until it touched the handle. "Keep it," said Nessus. He clamped his jaws on Speaker's arm and led the Kazin to a crash couch. The Kazin made no resistance. He was no longer making sounds. He stared into infinity, and his great furry face showed only a vast calm.
"What happened? What did you do?"
Speaker to Animals, totally relaxed, stared at infinity and purred.
"Watch," said Nessus.
He moved carefully back from the Kazin's crash couch. He held his flat heads high and rigid, not so much pointed as aimed, and at no time did his eyes leave the Kazin. The Kazin's eyes focused suddenly. They flicked from Louis to Teela to Nessus. Speaker to Animals made plaintive snarling sounds, sat upright, and switched to Interworld.
"That was very, very nice. I wish..."
He stopped and started over.
"Whatever you did," he told the puppeteer, "do not do it again."
"I judged you to be a sophisticate," said Nessus. "My judgment was accurate. Only a sophisticate would fear a TASP."
Teela said, "Ah."
Louis said, "TASP?"
The puppeteer addressed himself to Speaker to Animals.
"You understand that I will use the TASP every time you force me to.
I will use it if you make me uneasy. If you attempt violence too often, or if you startle me too often, you will soon become dependent on the TASP. Since the TASP is a surgically implanted part of me, you would have to kill me to possess it, and you would still be ignobly bound by the TASP itself.
Very astute, said the speaker. Brilliantly unorthodox tactics. I will trouble you no more.
Tonge, will somebody tell me what a TASP is? Louis's ignorance seemed to surprise everybody. It was Tila who answered. It jolts the pleasure center of the brain.
From a distance?
Louis hadn't known that that was even theoretically possible.
Sure, it does for you just what a touch of current does for a wire head. But you don't need to drop a wire into your brain. Usually a TASP is just small enough to aim with one hand.
Have you ever been hit by a TASP? None of my business, of course.
Tila grinned derision for his delicacy.
Yes, I know what it feels like. A moment of... well, there's no describing it. But you don't use a TASP on yourself. You use it on someone who isn't expecting it. That's where the fun comes in. Police are always picking up TASPers in the parks.
Your TASPs, said Nessus, induce less than a second of current. Mine induces prox 10 seconds.
The effect on speaker to animals must have been formidable, but Louis saw other implications.
Oh, wow, that's beautiful, that's lovely. Who but a puppeteer would go around with a weapon that does good to the enemy?
Who but a prideful sophisticate would fear too much pleasure? The puppeteer is quite right, said speaker to animals. I would not risk the TASP again. Too many jolts from the puppeteer's TASP would leave me his willing slave. I, a Kazin, slave to a herbivore.
Let us board the long shot, Nessus said grandly. We have wasted enough time on trivialities.
Louis was first aboard the long shot. He was not surprised to find his feet trying to dance on Nereid's rock surface. Louis knew how to move in low gravity, but his hind brain stupidly expected gravity to change as he entered the long shot's airlock. Braced for the change, he stumbled and almost fell when it didn't come.
I know they had induced gravity then, he grumbled as he moved into the cabin.
Oh.
The cabin was primitive. There were hard right angles everywhere, suitable for bumping knees and elbows. Everything was bulkier than necessary. Dials were badly placed. But more than primitive, the cabin was small. There had been induced gravity when the long shot was built, but even in a ship a mile wide, there had been no room for the machinery. There was barely room for a pilot. Instrument board and mass indicator, a kitchen slot, a crash couch, and a space behind the couch where a man might wedge himself with his head bent to the low ceiling. Louis braced himself in that space and opened the Kazin's variable sword to 3 feet. Speaker to animals came aboard, moving in self-conscious slow motion. He climbed past Louis without slowing, up into the overhead compartment. The overhead compartment had been a recreation room for the ship's single pilot. Exercise machinery and a reading screen had been ripped out, and 3 new crash couches installed. Speaker climbed into one of these. Now Louis followed him up the rungs, one-handed. Keeping the variable sword unostentatiously in sight, he closed the cover on the Kazin's crash couch and flipped a knife switch. The crash couch became a mirror-surface egg. Inside, no time would pass until Louis turned off the stasis field. If the ship should happen to ram an antimatter asteroid, even the general product's hull would be ionized vapor, but the Kazin's crash couch would not lose its mirror finish. Louis relaxed. It had all been like a kind of ritualistic dance, but its purpose was real enough. The Kazin had good reason to steal the ship. The TASP had not altered that. Speaker must not be given an opportunity. Louis returned to the pilot's cabin. He used the ship-to-suit circuit. Come on in. Something over 100 hours later, Louis Wu was outside the solar system.
Chapter 5. Rosette.
There are singularities in the mathematics of hyperspace. One such singularity surrounds every sufficiently large mass in the Einsteinian universe. Inside of these singularities, ships can travel faster than light.
Inside, they disappear if they try it. Now the long shot, some 8 light hours from Sol, was beyond Sol's local singularity. And Louis Wu was in free fall. There was tension in his gonads and discomfort in his diaphragm, and his stomach thought he wanted to belch. These sensations would pass. There was a paradoxical urge to fly. He had flown many times in freefall, in the huge transparent bubble of the outbound hotel, which circled Earth's moon. Here he would smash something vital if he so much as flapped his arms. He had chosen to accelerate outward under 2 gravities. For something like 5 days he had worked and eaten and slept in the pilot's crash couch. Despite the excellent facilities of the couch, he was dirty and unkempt. Despite 50 hours of sleep, he was exhausted. Louis felt his future foreshadowed. For him, the keynote of the expedition would be discomfort. The sky of deep space looked not so much different from the lunar night sky. In the solar system, the planets add little to a naked-eye view. One remarkably bright star glared in the galactic south, and that star was Sol. Louis used flywheel controls. The long shot rotated, and stars went by underneath his feet. 27, 312, 1,000 even. Nessus had given him these coordinates just before Louis closed the crash couch on him. They were the location of the puppeteer migration. And now Louis realized that this was not in the direction of either of the clouds of Magellan. The puppeteer had lied to him. But, Louis thought, it was about 200 light-years away, and it was along the galactic axis. Perhaps the puppeteers had chosen to move out of the galaxy along the shortest direction, then travel above the plane of the galaxy to reach the lesser cloud. Thus they would avoid interstellar debris, suns, dust clouds, hydrogen concentrations. It didn't particularly matter. Louis's hands, like a pianist's about to begin a concert, hovered over the instrument panel, descended. The long shot vanished. Louis kept his eyes away from the transparent floor. He had already stopped wondering why there were no covers for all that window space. The sight of the blind spot had driven good men mad, and there were those who could take it. The long shot's pilot must have been such a man. He looked instead at the mass pointer, a transparent sphere above the instrument panel, with a number of blue lines radiating from its center. This one was oversized, despite limitations on cabin space. Louis settled back and watched the lines. They changed visibly. Louis could fix his eye on a line and watch it sweep slowly across the curvature of the sphere. It was unusual and unnerving. At normal hyperdrive, speeds of the lines would remain fixed for hours. Louis flew with his left hand on the panic switch. The kitchen slot to his right fed him odd-tasting coffee and, later, a hand meal that came apart in his hands, into separate strata of meat and cheese and bread and some kind of leaf. The auto kitchen must be hundreds of years overdue for reprogramming. Radio lines in the mass indicator grew large and swept upward like the second hand on a watch and shrank to nothing. A fuzzy blue line at the bottom of the sphere grew long and longer. Louis pulled the panic switch. An unfamiliar red giant glared beneath his feet. "Too fast," Louis snarled. "Too tonge fast." In any normal ship, you only had to check the mass indicator every 6 hours or so. On the long shot, you hardly dared blink. Louis let his eyes drop to the bright, fuzzy red disk and its starry background. "Tonge, I'm already out of known space." He wheeled the ship to see the stars. A foreign sky streamed beneath him. "They're mine, all mine," Louis chortled, rubbing his hands together. On sabbaticals, Louis Wu was his own entertainment. The red star returned to view, and Louis let it swing another 90 degrees. He'd let his ship get too close to the star, and now he'd have to circle around it. He was then an hour and a half on his way. He was 3 hours on his way when he dropped out again. The foreign stars didn't bother him. City lights drowned the starlight over most of the Earth, and Louis Wu had been raised a flatlander. He had not seen a star until he was 26. He checked to be sure he was in clear space, he closed covers on instrument panels, and then, finally, he stretched. "Wow, my eyes feel like boiled onions." Releasing himself from the crash web, he floated, flexing his left hand. For 3 hours he had flown with that hand closed on the hyperdrive switch. From elbow to fingertips, it felt like a single cramp. Under the ceiling were rungs for isometric exercises. Louis used them. The kinks left his muscles, but he was still tired. Wake Teela?